The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
My guest this time on What's Your Story is Nancy Tate, a TV broadcaster for 22 years. She worked in public relations for the Science Museum of Virginia for 20 years, and as of September, she'll be consulting. Nancy, I'm going to start this program the way we start every one of these programs, and that's by asking this question. What's your earliest childhood memory?
My earliest childhood memory is the birth of my sister. I was two when she was born. And she ended up being born at home, which was not the norm, nor was it the plan, but that's what happened. And I don't remember the whole thing because it was in the room next to my bedroom. But what I remember is my father coming into the bedroom, and he had a look on his face that I never saw on his face again, but it just kind of melded into my head that this was a big deal. Something was going on that was a huge deal, and it was a good huge deal, but it was huge, and he was trying to say it to me without going into all kinds of detail. And he looked at me, and he said, "You have a baby sister. Her name is Susan Kelly." And I responded by saying, "I want to see the baby. I want to see the baby." But I don't remember actually ever seeing the baby. It's just that little vignette of Dad coming into my bedroom. And yeah, I was two for that one. And I think the thing I remember most is the look on his face.
Where was this?
This would have been in Haddon Heights, New Jersey, which is in South Jersey. It's like a suburb of Philadelphia.
As I recall, Nancy and I have known each other for some time. As I recall, you've lived in a lot of different places.
Yes.
What was the connection in New Jersey?
Well, actually, my parents were both from New Jersey. My mom grew up in North Jersey. My dad had grown up in South Jersey. He had actually gone to high school at Haddon Heights High because he was from a small town that was too small to have its own high school. So he had gone to another town for high school. And my parents met in college at Rutgers. And when they got married, Dad got a job in Philadelphia working for an accounting firm. He got his CPA after they got married and got a job in an accounting firm.
Did you live there long?
We lived in Haddon Heights until I was 8.
Aha.
And then we moved to Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Oh.
And that's where I grew up.
That conjures up very pleasant countryside.
Oh, beautiful town. And yes, there were a lot of farms outside of town then. And now it's, of course, all developed. But there were a lot of farms. It's horse country. So there were horse farms. And I grew up doing things like running after the hunts and watching the hunts happen. And my best friend lived right on the edge of town. And there were farms right across the street from her house. So we would run around farms a lot.
Where did you go to school?
School as in
high school?
High school. I went to B. Reed Henderson High School in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
And then college?
And in college, I went to Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania.
When did you
it's
study?
A small liberal arts school. I studied English with a minor in education. I thought I was going to be an English teacher. But very early in my freshman year, a friend of mine was looking for any excuse she could to go into the radio station, a campus radio station. She had developed a crush on the general manager. And so she's like, "You need to come see the radio station." So I was like, "Yeah, sure, why not?" So I went over to the radio station, and while we were talking to the general manager, this guy came up to me and said, "Hey, could you do me a favor and take this copy and go into that little studio and read this into the microphone?" I'm like, "Sure." So I did, and I walked out, and he offered me a job as co-anchor of our 6 o'clock newscast, which was 5 nights a week, half-hour show.
Wow.
Doing news. So I was co-anchor and co-producer of a radio news show for my entire college career, and I was acting news director of the radio station for a long time.
On such accidents and twists and turns, our careers made.
I know, and the funny thing about that is that my parents kept saying to me, "That is really neat. You're loving it." I was doing it for fun. I wasn't doing it for serious. It was just cool. And they said, "You should get some tapes of yourself doing that. You might want to do this for a job." And I'm like, "Ah, women don't do that for a living."
Well, in those days.
In those days, very few women did.
This would have been what, late 50s or early 60s?
This would have been, no, it was 68 to 72.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, women were not the routine in broadcasting
or
in so many industries outside of nursing and school teaching and secretaries.
There were fewer options. Barbara Walters was still a big deal for having anchors.
Right. Oh, sure.
And you interned, right, after college?
Actually, I got a job. It was a paying job that made me a whopping $84 a week.
Wow.
As a copy boy, that was the title, at a CBS-owned station in Philadelphia.
Which was?
It was WCAU, was owned by CBS at that point. And, you know, it was an O&O, and it was a huge station. And, you know, Pennsylvania is a big union state, so it had all the unions, and they had, you know, Directors Guild, and all of the reporters were union, and the photographers were union, and everybody was a union, but I was so low on the totem pole, I was kind of like a sub-union. You know, I didn't make enough money for the union to care about me. And I gave up graduate school and other opportunities to take this $84 a week job in television news, which I had worked really hard to get, because if you really want to know about unusual circumstances that lead you into something, in college, not only was I doing radio, but I was also doing theater. My senior year, I was kind of bored in January, and I saw an audition for a theater opportunity in the city, and it was with one of the city theater companies, not the campus thing. And I asked my drama coach about it, and he's like, they hate college students, but if you, you know, it's a great experience for you, so you should go for it. Well, I walked off with the lead on the play. It was called Voice of the Turtle. It's a three-person play, and as the lead, I was on stage for all but seven pages, of which, so, you know, there were fast changes in there. But then I started my student teaching, and a very good friend of mine was getting married, so I went to her wedding shower. And this tall, statuesque woman came up to me while I was sitting talking to my friends and goes, haven't I seen you before somewhere on stage? And I was like, oh, I'm so embarrassed. But anyway, she and I started talking. She said, what do you want to do for a living? And I said, oh, I want to be an English teacher. She said, no, you don't. She said, all the things you're doing, you want to go into television. Oh, that sounded cool. You know, what did I know? So I got out of college. I didn't have a job right away because teaching jobs were very scarce. The economy was tight. A lot of jobs were scarce at that point. And I went into Philadelphia and went to some employment agencies. They said, what do you want to do? I said, oh, television sounds like fun. And they said, you have to know somebody. And I didn't know anybody, so I just didn't worry about it. I took my graduate record exams the same day as my friend was getting married. She was getting married in North Jersey, so I took them up there. Went to her wedding, and standing in the reception talking to my friends, this woman appears again. I don't even know her name, but I recognized her. She said, do you remember me? I'm like, yes, I remember you. She said, well, did you get into television? And I told her what had happened. And this friend of mine said, oh, my brother's a sound man at Channel 6 in Philadelphia. He just carries around lights and sets up mics and lights, but he can get you to go out with a news crew if you want to do that. And I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. So she set this up, and I went there, and I was like, oh, they would actually pay me to do this? Hello, my life. This is awesome. And so the rest of the day I was there, I was bugging like everybody in the newsroom, all the way up to the news director about what do I have to do to get in? And they said, okay, this is what you have to do. You're going to have to bang on a lot of doors. Here's some guides. And here's like the broadcaster's yearbook that you can use to, you know who's who and what's what. And they said, the one thing you shouldn't do is take a job as a weather girl, because they said a weather girl has no future. This is before weather people were meteorologists and were taken seriously. So I just started bugging people, and I actually had a job that I turned job offer. I turned down. It would have been in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, as the weather girl. And I was like, no, I can't do the weather girl, because they said, if you're serious about news and you want to go into news, weather girl will hurt you. It won't help you. Mm-hmm. So that's why I took this $84 a week job in the Philadelphia station. And apparently the brass in New York was all like upset, because again, we can't have a woman in that job and call it copy boy. We need to come up with a new term. Apparently it took them about 3 months to come up with desk assistant. In the meantime, I've been promoted out of the job 7 weeks later into a job called news researcher.
And there came a time when you sent a tape to the news director at Channel 6.
I did, and that was you.
And that was me. And it was a good tape. And you came down and talked to me, and you got the job.
I did.
And you got the job that had been my job before I was promoted to news director. which was covering City Hall, right, among other things. And so, for me, it was like handing over your baby. So,
oh, okay, I'm sure.
Here is City Hall, Nancy. Take good care of it.
Oh, yes, yes. You kind of pointed City Hall out to me one day, right before I started really working, and said, okay, that's City Hall. That's your responsibility. All 17 stories of it. And you said, if you don't have a story on the 6 o'clock news that shows up the next day in the newspaper, you better have a real good reason why. And I was like, oh, what have I gotten myself into?
Well, it was so different in those days because the newspapers and television competed really seriously.
Yes, very seriously.
And television was determined to beat the newspapers, and mm-hmm. so they had the 6 o'clock news.
Oh, yeah.
And they could. Nowadays, you can read the newspaper in the morning and you can see the same story on the 6 o'clock news outside the cycle. In other words, television doesn't lead the way the way
right.
it used to.
Yes.
Especially
true.
In coverage of politics, government, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Somebody told me, it may have been you, that on your first couple of days at City Hall, you started either on the top floor or the basement. And you worked your way up, knocking on every door.
I did.
And saying, hi, I'm Nancy Tate, and I'm covering City Hall. And just remember did you really?
I did.
18 floors?
I did. And the Safety, Health, and Welfare Building, too.
Oh, my God, the Safety, Health, and Welfare Building, yes. That's kind of
that
derelict.
That was police
now.
And the social workers and the fire department.
I
did do that. I went and made myself well known to like everybody I possibly could imagine.
Do you remember your first story?
No.
Do you remember your biggest story?
Oh, yes.
What was that?
That would have been the Model Neighborhoods investigation.
Oh, yes. Which is a little inside baseball for people today.
Yes.
It would take a lot of explanation. But
it was $10 million in federal funds that nobody right. could account for.
Right.
And that's an easy way to describe it.
And you had a story a day for a long time.
Oh, yes. And that was my first really huge story. And I remember, we didn't turn it around right away because I needed to do a lot of investigating, and I still needed to turn daily stories as
right.
well as doing that. And I would carry it around with me, and any time I had free time, I would work on it. And eventually we got to the point where we decided, yes, we were ready to do the story on it. And you had a death in your family. Your brother, I believe
brother
it was. And
was
the day that you and I had agreed we were going to do the story. And so I wrote my script, and you were down the street having
right.
visitation.
At Bennett's funeral hall.
Yes, and I took my story down to you.
And we went into the kitchen
yes.
of the funeral home, and
yes.
we read over your
yes.
story and
yes.
discussed how to play it.
Yes.
And this was like a couple of hours before news time.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Real close.
Oh yeah, it was close.
You and I were just talking before we started recording. There was no wireless anything. There was no live microwave shots. It was all film. It was a different beast completely.
Oh, very.
Because you had this other variable in there of film rather than videotape or
right,
just video.
Which was nowhere near as immediate.
Which, exactly. And you couldn't do anything live, and so you'd do a lot of pieces sitting in the studio.
Right, because that was a set piece.
Right. And you've worked long enough in television. I've seen you report live from a helicopter
oh, yes.
since then. Do you notice a big change, or how did you feel about the coming of live?
Oh, I loved it. Live shots, and I've never had a lot of interest in being an anchor, but I loved live shots at breaking news. That was it was an adrenaline rush. It was just so amazing when things would fall together and you were on live TV, and probably one of the most amazing live opportunities that I had and stories that I did. It was a fatal truck accident during rush hour traffic and trying to get to the site of it because I had to go live from the site. At the time I was going, we did not know there were any fatalities. We just knew it was a big traffic accident. It was just blocking up everything in the world. I got lost getting there because the traffic was so bad and I'm stuck in traffic and trying to get there. And literally, I have seconds from the time I pull up to the live truck to just kind of like fluff my hair and hope I look decent and go grab the mic. And as I'm running down to my live shot, I get to, there was a fence, you know, police tape, well, you know, they'd had it all cordoned off. And then this fire chief that I knew very well came up to me and said, "Hey, Nancy, we got a fatality." I'm like, "I'm getting ready to go live. Do you want to just stay here and tell us all about it?" That he had held that. Nobody else knew that until I got there, and everybody found out when my audience found out. Well, and I found out at that time, too.
You stayed at Channel 6 after I left and went to the Virginia Museum. What happened after you left Channel 6 and you went to
Connecticut?
Connecticut. And you worked in television there?
At the NBC station in Hartford.
Oh, okay. Big market.
A bigger market. It was like mid-30s, and I think at that time Richmond was mid-60s. 50,
yeah. Low 60s, upper 50s.
Yeah, it tended to fluctuate in those areas. And that, of course, is area based on population.
And what happened after that? How did you get to the Science Museum from television?
Well, I was in Connecticut for 3 years, and then I went to D.C., and I worked at a bureau and created, like, my own network of television stations all across the country where I did their D.C. work. And then I went into production for a couple of years in D.C., and I missed news, really, big time. So I went looking for a news job again, and Channel 12 in Richmond hired me.
Hold that thought, because I want to remind our listeners we're talking to Nancy Tate, who's been a TV broadcaster for 22 years and then spent 20 years at the Science Museum of Virginia doing public relations. Channel 12, I remember vividly, I was talking about the helicopter shot earlier. That was during a storm.
Yes, it was.
That had wiped out a Walmart in
Petersburg.
And there's Nancy broadcasting live from a helicopter, and this was no more than a few hours after it had happened.
Oh, yeah.
And that must have been...
I was up in that helicopter for about 8 hours that day.
That must be high on your list of memories.
Very much so, because, of course, it was an extremely new experience to be up there flying over something that had just happened.
And it was a devastating storm.
Oh, it was devastating.
It ripped the roof right off the place.
It did. It was. I remember looking down at the, I think it was a Walmart. It was a big box store for sure.
Right.
And it looked like somebody had punched a corner of it and then just tore off part of the roof. Because I remember describing that on the air, because that's what it looked like. And all these things that had looked like houses and looked so substantial, you know, hours before that just looked like child's toys that had just been spewed all over the place.
Everybody uses that metaphor.
That's what it looks like.
Because that's what it looks like. You always hear it looks like a war zone.
Right.
Or it looks like children's toys have been scattered around.
It does.
And you were 8 hours
in the helicopter. I think we took like two breaks during that day because it was such a big story that we were going live constantly. They had suspended other programming and we went live. I was working the night shift then, which meant I normally came in about 2:30, and they had me come in early that day. And basically I came in immediately, got in the helicopter and went up. And other than I think we took two very short breaks, but basically stayed in the helicopter for a long, long time just broadcasting live.
Well, you never know when you go to work in the news profession what you're going to be doing 8 hours from now.
And sometimes it's longer than 8 hours,
exactly.
Too.
You might not be home for dinner.
Right. There may be the double shift days.
Exactly. As I recall, you covered a pretty significant murder case, too, while you were at Channel 12.
Yes. Yes.
It was a teenager from Lakeside who had harmed his family, I believe.
I think you may be right.
Yeah, and everybody was following that story.
Right.
And you made a big leap forward in it on a Saturday
morning.
It
was amazing. It was amazing because the car had been found on a boat dock in Goochland. And this was on the same Saturday where there hadn't been any really big news stories. And as soon as I got the word that was it, we suspended everything and headed on out there to get the car and get the car. We got the car being pulled up the boat dock and put on the tow truck and driven away. And nobody else got it. And that was the same day there was a sniper at I think it was what was then the Howard Johnson that was taking pot shots at I-95. So they had closed up 95, and they had this guy holed up in the hotel. And most of the news people were there covering it, and I wasn't there. So they thought, Nancy's missing the big story. Nancy's missing the big story. And when I finally got there, everybody was giving me grief about, well, where have you been? This is the big story. There's nothing else going on in town. Of course, I didn't tell them that I'm sitting there on the curb while we're waiting for something to break on this hotel story, writing what was really going to be much more exciting for them.
You know, it must have been a huge...
Yeah, the newspaper had to call us to use a picture on the front page that day.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty big.
Yeah. It must have been a big change to go to work for the Science Museum.
It was.
Change in adrenaline level.
Yeah, a lot of change in adrenaline level.
You know you're going home at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Most nights.
Yeah, if you knew you were not going to be working a normal day, you generally had advance notice. It wasn't a last minute, we need you to do this.
And the Science Museum was just beginning to come into its own. It was becoming a destination, a respected destination.
And you actually had something to do with me looking at that job, too. I don't know if you remember. You knew I was looking around because I'd pretty much done everything that I could do at Channel 12. And I didn't really have any interest in pursuing an anchor job. And I was kind of tired of playing professional gypsy, you know, moving around a lot. So I figured if I could find a job that was really interesting where I could still tell stories, that I'd stay in Richmond. And you called me up and said, the Science Museum's looking for my counterpart and they need you. Nobody's telling your stories right now. So I went and applied for that job because you told me that was open.
It is a small town.
It is a very small town.
I had forgotten that.
Oh, not me.
Well, what was your job at the Science Museum like? What did you enjoy it?
I did, and I love telling the stories because the museum had lots of interesting and unusual things going on. And of course, as media and changed over the years, and you know, digital media came in, and the changes that go with that, and everything, it was really kind of fun to target stories to different media and different reporters, and kind of spread the word in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Did you know anything about science before you went there?
Actually, I'm like the only person in my family that did not study science in college.
I'd never had an art history course in my life before I went to work at the Virginia.
I had one. I had an art history course.
I learned on the job.
But I thought it was interesting learning on the job because one of the things that I thought was really important for the Science Museum was the fact that a lot of people do not equate fun with science. And so I felt like my job was to find what is the cool stuff, what is the fun stuff to get people excited from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Those were the days when I always felt at the Virginia Museum that my job was 50% explaining the museum to the public and 50% explaining the media to the museum.
Oh, yes.
The museum had been focused for years, and so had the Science Museum, as all organizations had, on print media.
Right.
And here come these brash television-trained people who say there's a whole new audience out there.
That's
and we're getting them interviews on television, and suddenly the world changed.
And that was one of the reasons they hired me, because Walter Witchy was the director at that time, and he basically said to me, we need television coverage.
Right.
And he had seen me on television. I remember having my interview with the marketing director because it was a job in the marketing department. And she immediately said, oh, our director would like to meet with you right now. And I thought, oh, so this is like TV. When they're hiring you, they take you to the general manager. So so I kind of equated it with that. And I walked into this office. And this gentleman stood up and stuck out his hand and said, you don't know me, but you've been in my living room for the last 5 years. I thought, okay, this has sounded pretty good.
Yeah, that's always nice to hear.
It was very good to hear. But yeah, they really wanted to focus in on TV, and that was before we had social media and so many of the other things that are out there now.
It's changed so much. Did you have a hard time keeping up?
I thought it was fascinating just to see, because when I was in Washington, that was when cable TV and satellite technology was really taking off. We'd had microwave, but satellite technology was really taking off. And that was my first experience with doing a lot of booking satellite time and figuring all of that out. And so I was really starting to do a lot of live shots and using satellites when I was in D.C.
The big deal now.
But it seemed to me that media was changing, and I kind of thought that it was going to be interesting to see where it went, because I knew that TV as a license to print money was going to change drastically with the innovation of cable and satellite. Yeah. Now, I didn't know where it was going to go. I certainly didn't predict digital, but I always knew it was going to keep on changing, and I'm very curious still to see where it's going to go from here. One of my stations when I was in D.C. was in Honolulu. It was a CBS station in Honolulu. And I had everything that I sent to them had to double hop down there, because you went up, you hit the bird, it went back down in San Diego, and then hopped from San Diego to Honolulu.
On another bird.
Yes, on another bird. And I had done when the Vietnam Memorial was dedicated. Uh-huh. That was a big news coverage day for us. And I'd had a lot of my stations wanted me to cover their delegations, and one of them was the Hawaii one. And the only directions they had given me was, we want you to talk to Native Hawaiians. So that's fine. And I knew where their delegation was going to be. And I went and I found them. And I talked to this big dock worker, union organizer, who had been in the war. And he like burst into tears about the buddy whose name he really wanted to see. Because on his last day, he was supposed to go take one more flight in a helicopter. And his buddy said, I'll go for you. It's your last day. And the buddy never came home. So here's this big dock worker, just tears streaming down his face, talking about it. And I thought, oh, you cannot do more than that. I mean, it was an amazing story. And then I found this little Native Hawaiian woman who was telling me about her son. And she didn't want him to go to the war, but he said, Mom, if I don't go, who's going to protect you? So I need to go. So he had gone, and I said, well, do you feel closer to him seeing his name on the wall? And she said, no, he's buried in Hawaii, and I go to the grave. So I know that's here. She said, but when I look at the wall and I see all the other names up there, I know I'm not the only mother that has to cry. And as she said that, a tear started rolling down her face. And the last thing you see in that piece is my arm grabbing her to hug her, because it was just amazing. So I have these two fabulous stories. And of course, it's television. You have time constraints. I'm thinking, how am I going to get these into a minute and a half?
Yeah.
Because they both were really spectacular stories. And I called my assignment editor in Honolulu and I said, hey, how much time do I have this piece? He said, Nancy, this is Honolulu. Dressing up means putting on your shoes. You just tell your story. Don't you worry about how long it is. If we run over for your story, it'll be worth it. Okay. So I wrote him this
what great news.
2.5 minute mama of a piece. And we still had to do double hops. So we had it all together. It wasn't going to be a live piece. It was a package. It was all pre-done. And I gave it to the engineer to send it. He came back a few minutes later. He said, Nancy, you have engineers crying from here to Honolulu as they see this piece. It was a fabulous piece. That actually was the last piece on my audition tape that got me the job at Channel 12.
Nancy and I have known each other for donkey's years. And I think she's probably one of the best reporters I ever had the pleasure of working with.
Well, thank you.
She would never give up. She was like a dog with a bone.
You always call me that.
Well, it's a good trait for a reporter. And this being radio, we have time constraints of our own. Nancy, one last question. How would you sum it all up? Have you been happy with your life?
Oh, yeah, life, some of it has been fabulous, some of it has been dreadful. Professionally, it wasn't dreadful. Would I do it over again? Yes. Talk about a fulfilling life with opportunities that I can't imagine I would have had any other way. I mean, it was a fabulous way to live.
Well, good. That's good to hear. It's good to hear. Nancy, thank you so much
for
letting me talk to you today. My guest this time on What's Your Story has been Nancy Tate, TV broadcaster familiar to Richmonders for 22 years, PR at the Science Museum for another 20 years, and as of September 2nd, she'll be out there consulting, and I guarantee you she'll deliver what she promises. Thanks again, Nancy. I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.